Welcome back. It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Curwood. This week, we're celebrating the holiday season with stories of community with writers Judy Blunt, Lyle Watson, and Jake Halpern. Jake, the community you're about to tell us about is not your average Main Street Central sort of town. How did you first hear of Whittier, Alaska, anyway?
You know, I was working in a magazine, and someone had told me that they'd heard a story about a town in Alaska that was in the middle of the Alaskan wilderness, and the whole town existed in one building. And the building got cut off from the world by avalanches and, you know, annual 20 feet of snow. And it sounded, you know, implausible. It sounded like a science fiction set. And my curiosity was piqued.
So off you went. And I gather one of the people that you meet in your story about this town is a woman named Babs Reynolds. And she's one of the few who, I guess, have stuck it out in this remote outpost for many years. And for this segment of the show, we've asked her to listen in to your story from her home in Whittier. Babs, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, Jake, now the storytelling circle here is yours. Can you read your story for us now?
Sure. As I read back Babs' lines, I hope that I do your voice justice, Babs. All right, we'll start here. Reportedly, somewhere in the remote coves of Prince William Sound, there was a 14-story high-rise nestled among the glaciers. This single, snowbound building was the city of Whittier, Alaska. Perhaps what intrigued me most, however, was Whittier's lone entranceway, a 2.5-mile-long railroad tunnel that burrowed beneath the surrounding wall of mountains and brought a train into town several times a week. Recently, the state of Alaska had modified the tunnel to install an accompanying road for cars and buses. People in Whittier were miffed. From what I read in the Anchorage Daily News, most residents treasured their fortified isolation. They didn't want the road, and a few, including an outspoken diehard named Babs Reynolds, promised to fight it to the bitter end. Whittier owed its existence to the United States military, which initially conceived it as a fortified seaport. Anchorage traditionally relied on port towns like Seward for its shipping. Yet as World War II began, the military insisted on a closer and more secure port for its operations. In August of 1941, engineers began drilling a 2.5-mile hole through the mountains to a narrow shelf of rock on the other side, which they called Whittier. The name came from the Quaker poet John Greenleaf Whittier, whose poems often describe the rugged beauty of the seasons, including the awesome power of winter. In 1956, the military completed a 14-story high-rise that qualified as the tallest building in Alaska. The Pentagon hoped that Whittier would be not just a secure port, but also a lookout onto the Soviet Union, which sat just a few hundred miles to the west. Yet, just a few short years later, the entire project was abandoned. Ultimately, Whittier was left to a handful of civilians who called it home. According to the 2000 census, precisely 182 people now lived in the city of Whittier, and I wanted to know more about them. Naturally, I was curious about Whittier's avalanches and its harsh, wintry environs, but this was just part of it. Whittier promised to offer something new, not just the story of man versus the great outdoors, but also of man versus the great indoors. After flying to Anchorage, I hired a reluctant taxi driver who navigated me across a series of snow-covered mountains and through the 2.5-mile-long tunnel that led to the giant tower that was Whittier, where I planned to spend the next 2 weeks. The first-floor hallway is the center of daily life in Whittier, the equivalent of Main Street in a normal town. Along this vast, windowless stretch, I found a series of rooms containing the post office, the laundromat, the general store, the weather station, city hall, police headquarters, and a shop called Cabin Fever. At both ends of the building, there were elevators leading to the residential floors above. By the time I arrived, the first-floor hallway had shut down for the night, and there was hardly a person in sight. Eventually, I wandered into Cabin Fever, which occupied a very cramped one-bedroom apartment at the far end of the hallway and functioned as the town's video store and tanning salon. It was here that I met Babs Reynolds. Babs was sitting in a walk-in closet outfitted with a small desk and a wraparound bookcase with several hundred movies, including a great many horror and action flicks. She was of medium height and buxom, a hardy woman in her early 60s whose face was daubed with makeup and whose skin was deeply bronzed from the generous use of liquid tanner. Her clothes were all denim. Between her breasts rested a lone ornament, a small leather holster for her lighter, which hung as a necklace on a piece of rawhide. We exchanged pleasantries for a few minutes, during which time she used her necklace to light a long, brown menthol cigarette that resembled a small cigar. "So, what do you think of Whittier?" she asked me finally, in a deep, throaty drawl. "Well, when I first came to the tunnel, I was a little spooked out," I admitted. "Yeah, well, who wouldn't be?" said Babs, with a laugh. She reached into the desk drawer and pulled out a deck of cards and began dealing herself a round of solitaire, which she played effortlessly, as if for the 10,000th time. "When I first got here, I couldn't believe it either," she said, without looking up. "Well, did you think of turning around?" I asked. "Not for a moment," replied Babs. "Well, I had an ex-husband on the other side who was trying to kill me." Neither of us spoke for a moment. Babs glanced up at a small TV that was hanging from the ceiling, and as she did this, I noticed several scars on her chin. Before she came to Whittier, her ex-husband used to beat her, and on one occasion he broke her jaw, and the scars marked the places where a doctor had drilled several magnesium bolts into her mandible and connected them to a fiberglass brace. Upon arriving in Whittier in the summer of 1978, Babs showed a picture of her third husband to the train crew and explained that he was out to kill her. "Back then, the train was the only way into Whittier, and the train crew controlled who got in and who got out," said Babs. "So I told them my situation, and they told me not to worry." In the coming years, the crew made good on its promise, never once letting Babs' husband aboard an incoming train. I chatted with Babs until closing time, and as she locked up cabin fever for the night, I asked if I could help out with her newspaper route the following day. "Sure, that'd be nice," said Babs. "Be downstairs at 9 o'clock tomorrow, and we'll head over to the tunnel to pick up the papers. And if you're lucky, I'll make you breakfast afterwards." From cabin fever, I headed upstairs to the local B&B where I'd made reservations, quite unnecessarily as it turns out, for I was the only guest. I rode the elevator to the 9th floor where I met Kathy Elliott, a timid, white-haired woman who helped run the B&B. "How's the weather outside?" she asked. "Oh, cold," I told her. "Oh, I'm sure it is," said Kathy, who went on to explain that she hadn't left the high-rise in weeks. "I like going outside, but it drains you," said Kathy. "When you come back indoors to a man-made situation, you have to acclimate. I guess it's something like what the astronauts go through." "So you just stay inside for weeks at a time?" I asked. "Oh, I've stayed inside for months at a time," explained Kathy. "In the wintertime, I hibernate like an old bear." I took my key and proceeded to the 14th floor where the B&B was located. The elevator doors opened onto the building's many long linoleum quarters. The inside of the high-rise was a hybrid of several institutional styles of architecture, part 1950s college dormitory, part aging mental institution, and part nuclear fallout shelter, the effect of which was immediately confining and at times creepy. The tower has two major joints or gaps that allow the structure to flex properly in the event of an earthquake. The practical effect, however, was that of a massive wind vent causing the entire building to creak and groan through the night. "Sometimes," one resident told me, "in the middle of the night you'll sit up in bed and ask yourself, 'What do I hear?' And the answer is nothing. The wind has finally stopped, and the silence is enough to wake you." After a restless first night of sleep, I met Babs at 9 a.m. the following morning to help out with the newspapers. She drove her weather-beaten pickup truck out towards the tunnel, and together we struggled to see through the steadily falling snow. "So how's this road working out?" I asked finally. "Well, it's here, so we use it," said Babs. "But right until that first car came through, I had to believe it wasn't going to open." Babs dug into the depths of her winter coat, pulled out her necklace lighter, and lit another of her menthols. "You gotta understand, I came here over 20 years ago running for my life. Coming here, I found safety in some of the most beautiful country you'll ever see. And I wasn't the only one. A lot of people came here running from something." This is something I would hear again and again in Whittier. People came through the tunnel on the run from a whole gamut of troubles. Ex-husbands, ex-wives, parents, jobs, warrants, child support, God, or just perhaps themselves. Alaska was as far away as they could go and still speak English, and Whittier was a good safe leap beyond that. Babs popped open the driver's side door and stepped out into a powdery patch of knee-deep snow. "I'm going to check and see if the tunnel crew already dropped off the papers," she told me. I followed her through the snow to a partially submerged phone booth. I helped her pry open the door, and inside we found several dozen copies of the Anchorage Daily News. We carried the newspapers back to Babs' truck. By now the wind was really howling, and both of us hurried into the front seat. "The way I see it, this road was done to us, not for us," concluded Babs. "They brought us the world. Hell, we could have had the world if we wanted it, but we didn't. That's why we all ended up here." Two other reasons for Babs not to go anywhere were her younger sisters, Brenda and Carolyn, both of whom had followed her to Whittier. Carolyn Ray Casabir, the middle sister, was a lifelong wanderer who rarely stayed anywhere for more than a year at a time. She had moved to Whittier 5 different times and was currently living in an apartment on the 10th floor of the high-rise, which was furnished with a few Spartan items, including a wooden box with an open plane ticket in it. Brenda Tolman, the younger sister, arrived in 1982 and had been in Whittier ever since. Brenda was a professional artist. She had a studio on the first floor of the high-rise, but she lived next door to Babs in the Whittier Manor, a small, snow-entrenched bungalow next to the tower. Despite the fact that Brenda and Babs lived next door to one another and relied on each other to do everything from running the weather station to lassoing runaway reindeer, Babs told me that they once went for 2 years without talking. "Well, we used to pass in the hallway or ride up the same elevator without even looking up," she explained. "It was like we didn't exist for one another." In addition to being somewhat standoffish, the two were highly competitive, not just for my attention, but for the attention of the entire town, it seemed. Carolyn, the middle sister, explained this best. "My sisters are like celebrities around here," she told me when I visited her on the 11th floor apartment. "I mean, sometimes you think they'd stop world hunger or something," she added with a laugh. "How much longer are you going to be in Whittier?" I asked. "I have absolutely no idea," she told me. "Everything here is so simple and secure, and when I left in the past, I've thought, what have I done? Suddenly I had to start carrying a wallet again. I had to worry about rent, utilities, job, everything. For me, that's the real world. I need that. But what do I know? Maybe this is really paradise and I'm just too much of a damn fool to see it." On the morning of my departure, Babs offered to drive me to the airport. Around 10 a.m., we set out in her pickup truck, driving south along the snow-covered bends of Portage Valley through a forest of trees whose branches were hung with long, delicate icicles that fell and shattered like champagne glasses whenever the wind blew. We took the Seward Highway into Anchorage and, just to kill a bit of time, drove down 4th Avenue past the honky-tonks where Babs once tended bar. "Not much left here," she muttered as we sped down 4th Avenue so quickly it was impossible for me to see much of anything. About half an hour later, we pulled into the airport. "I'm not big on goodbyes," she said, "but you know where to find me if you ever want to come back." Bab slammed on the brake, stopping just long enough for me to plant both feet on the curb, and then she was gone.
Great story, Jay. Thanks so much. And we do have Babs Rennell here on the line with us right now. Babs, what did you think of Whittier when you first came through that tunnel?
The first time I came through the tunnel, I was running for my life. And when you find something secure, everything looks better.
Okay.
And you have to put everything into a positive mode. And it was absolutely beautiful here. And I was free to go out and walk around on the street or do anything I wanted to. And so my first thought coming into town was, wow, this has got to be the greatest place in the world.
Well, what kind of person comes to Whittier and stays, Babs?
Well, I don't know if they're really stupid or if they've just got a lot of guts and they want to do something really different, you know, or if they're forced into it. I was pretty much forced into it and made the best of a bad situation, obviously. I'd lived in Anchorage for quite a while. I knew lots of people on that side. I had quite a social life over there, you know, having been in the bar business and stuff. And it was just totally different coming over here. It was like opening up one door after you'd closed another one.
Hmm. I just want to add that there are other people, obviously, besides Babs and Whittier, and the reason I think I was drawn to her to write about her is because through her kind of extraordinary willpower, she's made Whittier a homey place for herself. Her apartment is incredibly welcoming. The video store and tanning salon that she set up is, you know, one of the few places where people interact. The same goes for the burger stand that she created. And what impressed me about Babs was that, to my mind, in a very kind of inhospitable place, she had really worked hard to carve out a nice home for herself.
Yeah, I mean, it would occur to me that this isn't a place that would ordinarily attract a lot of gregarious people, that they go off to the end of the planet so they could be by themselves and want to keep to themselves. In fact, I'm surprised that you got people to open up and tell you their stories.
Well, Babs helped me on that. She really did. I mean, I think after I befriended Babs, I think people's suspicion of me kind of, you know, I was the guy helping Babs out with the newspapers or whatnot, and she really kind of gave me a stepping stone into the community, which is...
Yeah, plus nobody ever stays at my house, and I let him camp here, and that I guess everybody figured, well, if I would let him stay in my house, he must be all right.
Oh, you got the tongues of wagon there, huh? Jake, I want to get our other storytellers to comment here in just a moment, but I have to say, there's one description you have of the city which really just grabbed me, and it's this quote, that it's not just a story of man versus the great outdoors, but also of man versus the great indoors.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that you're struck by in Whittier, is that the people that make it are people that essentially don't freak out at being inside and kind of contained. And a lot of people are not as strong as Babs. I mean, it's kind of a well-known phenomenon of people just cracking it, kind of the claustrophobia doing them in. And so, you know, the irony of this is, you know, Alaska's, you know, the last frontier, but in this town, to survive, you have to be able to make it indoors.
Judy, now you grew up in a small town, in a town that's getting smaller and smaller. What similarities do you see between rural Montana and the high-rise community of Whittier, Alaska?
I thought it was interesting, the similarity between when they started to put gravel on the road to my community south of Malta, Montana. And there was a lot of resistance to that because it suddenly struck everyone after they'd argued for a long time to get new roads in there so that they could get out, that those roads went two ways. And if they could get out, that meant that other people could get in. And suddenly they had to start locking their fuel pumps and worrying about kids being able to drive out of town and rake havoc in the rural communities.
And Lyle Watson, what are your thoughts?
I'm intrigued by Whittier because I'm not afraid of being alone. I spend a lot of my time on my own. But being in a small community in a closed, weather-bound condition would give me cabin fever. I think that's a great name for a bar. If I were there long enough, I'd be in a chronic state of perpetual claustrophobia. It happens to places that Kurt Vonnegut described as grand faloons, and he meant artificial associations of small numbers of people that is never going to work.
This place strikes me as a wonderful retirement home for former submarine workers, long-term space station inhabitants, that sort of thing. What do you think, Babs?
Well, it's bad in the wintertime, and when the people get really old, a lot of them have had to move out of here because they're not able to get in and out of their vehicles because there's so much ice.
Uh-oh. So what are you going to do as retirement approaches?
I'm going to keep all my jobs on the ground floor.
Babs, you should tell them what your plan is for when you go down at the burger stand.
Well, I know. People keep asking me if I'm going to retire. Now, I'm only 65, so, you know, I'm not looking at any kind of a break here anytime soon. But probably the best thing that could happen would be if I was down cooking hamburgers in the summertime, and I just fell over and died, and my sister come down and threw me on the grill and barbecued me, and my ashes went out to the ocean, and that would be perfect.
Well, Jake Halperin, I want to thank you for your wonderful story. And Babs, thanks for taking this time.
Thanks for visiting with me.
Still ahead, a story of a boys' club in the wild. You're listening to NPR's Living on Earth.
Funding for Living on Earth comes from the World Media Foundation Environmental Information Fund. Major contributors include the Oak Foundation, supporting coverage of marine issues, and the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation. Support also comes from NPR member stations and Bob Williams and Meg Caldwell, honoring NPR's coverage of environmental and natural resource issues, and in support of the NPR President's Council. And Paul and Marcia Ginsburg, in support of excellence in public radio.